All right, this is tape two, side A. We were talking about schooling and cohorts. I wanted to ask, were there any other critical events? We've mentioned, I think you've covered quite a few of these, but were there any other critical events that I'm not picking up by talking about schooling and talking about cohorts and other things, events that were important in developing you? And these could be, sicknesses, accidents, they could be parties, they could be anything at all. I'm just sort of throwing out a net, I guess.
Let's see. Nothing comes to mind. So in one sense, I'm wondering now if my memory, I find it so much at fault, but it's associative, so there may well be things that occur later on.
Okay.
As they arise. But overall, my impression is that not really precipitating events. I feel like all along I was the sort of, what got me to do science was something that was there all along.
Right.
That it was just a matter of gradual development. That I always had that sort of goal. The way, determining events, maybe just because they're more recent, I have memories of things or decisions that I've made more recently, but not early on.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, almost always, I often find that when I've made faced some critical decision, that I find once I've actually declared the decision, I have the impression that actually the decision had already been made a long time previously.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more a matter of coming to express it.
Right.
And the process of making a decision is something, and even in terms of neurobiology, that's one of the questions, that one of the deep questions I've always found interesting, and I doubt that I'll ever get to approach it experimentally, but what actually happens when you make a decision, and what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you find that interesting, too, because I often think of it as tumblers that mm-hmm. sort of fall mysteriously into place. We don't quite know what the combination is, but there they are, and one day they fall into place.
Yeah.
The lock opens, as it were. We come to our decision. That's not a very, scientific explanation, but it's the best I can do. How about religion? Ireland, obviously.
I was kind of wondering when we get to religion. For interviewing somebody Irish, you've held off for...
Exactly, so I've got to ask, what was the impact of religion on you and your family?
Less constraining than you might expect by the reputation of, by stories of Irish children.
Right.
And the fact that I was educated in a religious-run school. In fact, pretty much all Irish schools, whether they're public or not, are in fact religious-run. They used to be. The local parish priest was the school manager, even in a public school. The separation of church and state is not caught on really there.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening now, but not for other reasons. I think we were reared Catholic. My mother and father were and are. They would call themselves devout Catholics, probably. I'm not sure they would. They would use the word devout because it would smack of a little too much pretentiousness for an Irish person to express it of themselves.
Mm.
There is, that said, there was always a, Aaron, to let us know that there is enough of Irish in them, and Irish Catholicism has always had this strain of contrariness and skepticism. That yes, we're devout Catholics, yes, we obey the Pope, but you don't really want to go along with everything he says. Because
interesting.
So the ability to, who was it said, the ability to uphold two opposed ideas and is either the sign of a first-rate mind or the sign of an Irish.
That's interesting.
The Irish have all, it's a strength, I think, usually a strength that you can hold to, frequently required if you regard yourself as Catholic, that you'll, and yet function in the world, that you hold opposed ideas in your mind at once. I would no longer consider myself Catholic. I certainly did all the way through high school and got, even sort of got in, there was a what was called charismatic movement in the Catholic Church that, you know, had, which was sort of an emotional, sort of touchy-feely approach to faith that was in part a reaction against rigid, punitive strain of Catholicism, and got involved in that for a while. In some ways, it sort of went as far as I could to answering emotional needs that were, you know, weren't otherwise met around the time I was leaving school. But it couldn't as far as any time it would come into conflict with that sort of sense of curiosity, need to explore, need to figure out things, how things really worked, i.e. science went hands down. But I'm not sure, again, partly because I'm Irish and you can be contrary, it never really came to a conflict. I did not have any dark nights of the soul wrestling, it's this or that. I would have, when I came to the US, I think I was still going to Mass at decreasing intervals, but almost as much of a sense of identity for the replicate the rituals, and even still, I still do that. Mm-hmm. And I still think that I wouldn't regard myself as Catholic. I would still want my children to be exposed enough to religion so that it doesn't seem something that's alien. So it's not, even though Catholic Church does seem to be pretty alienating these days.
Mm-hmm. You have a daughter.
I have a daughter and a son.
Okay.
Daughter's 7, son's 4.
And is she being brought up Catholic?
No.
Or?
No. No, she was baptized because of grandparental pressure, and
right.
it's a big topic now for us. The conflict arises there, you know, because that's when you really have to decide, make a conscious decision. What are we going to do? And so far, we're saying no. When it comes down to it, I just can't tell my daughter it's something I don't believe in. That goes against the grain.
Yeah.
So I've had family tensions have arisen out of decisions, you know,
but not between you and your wife, but between you and
between
your parents.
Between my parents, yeah.
Right. Okay. Is your wife, by the way, Catholic? Or?
No. Okay. She is also I don't know, has described herself sometimes, or I describe her as the least spiritual person I've ever met. Maybe that's why I married her, but she's the daughter of a Presbyterian minister. Or
something. Oh, okay.
Presbyterian minister. And her parents are still quite very religious and practice, and
right.
are involved in very much in church work. And he is a combination of a Presbyterian and a nuclear minister and a nuclear physicist. So that you don't want to mess with. He's got the spiritual and temporal powers.
Mm-hmm. When you return to Dublin and you're with your parents and Sunday morning rolls around, do you go with them to church or do they go to church still?
I might go, but probably not.
Mm-hmm.
And I might go just to, you know, to be in the same church again and just to see faces. And I would not say, if it came down to, am I going to go out, you know, go for a... plan a trip or a hiking trip or something that I might try and fit into a trip there. I would not do it because it was Sunday or anything like that. I've wondered, seeing, you know, whether they've become less. They were never dogmatic, and like I said, they always had a grain of skepticism and allowed us. We had plenty of arguments, but. But usually we just let them lie. And I don't feel like religion was never a constraint or a burden.
I'm sorry.
It was just another way of looking at the world,
yeah.
Which eventually I found to be incompatible with the scientific worldview.
Right. Okay. Do you feel, when you're growing up, that your parents had expectations for you in any way?
Yes.
In what way? In what way?
I was obviously smart and bookish and able to think, and they really did and do believe that you should use your talents, and that I should make use of them. I think I probably, you know, of course, you only realize how frustrating and annoying you must have been to your parents when you see the same thing happening in your own children.
Right.
So I would have appeared to them at times as, you know, frustratingly withdrawn, uncommunicative. It's probably to the extent where I didn't seem to care about any of the things they were trying to push me to do, but I think my mother in particular, I think, was ambitious for me.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, how did that express itself? How did you know?
Because she'd be always after me. Mm-hmm. Have you done this? Have you done that?
Making sure you did your homework.
And making sure I did my homework.
Right. Let's get back to Trinity College. When you enter Trinity College, by the second year, as you say, you had to choose pretty much your major. That's what we would call it in America,
right.
I guess. Describe a little bit of your time at Trinity College, both sort of academically and also socially. Maybe one way would be, what were some of, were you part of a groups or
yes.
fraternities? Or
Nothing so organized as a fraternity.
Right.
Was totally. But I got, fraternities to Irish eyes just seem so strange, so weird.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of sticking a label on yourself like that would just be not done. But that said, however, there were things that functionally were fraternities or fraternity plus sorority. There was a mixed group of, I mean, one of the big changes was, gosh, I get to hang around with women.
Mm-hmm.
Because Belvedere, of course, was an all male school.
Right.
And so being able to, in biology in particular, it was probably more women than men and groups nucleated. There was a pretty close-knit group that nucleated, certainly once that was socially functioned very, very extremely well as a social group. As always, a matter of social survival, you know, parties would be organized, make sure that nobody's gets left out. People, you know, lunches would be together, always in groups. And this seems, you know, in some ways normal, but I found, for me, that was a place I felt I really belonged. Both from the fact that I was studying what I really wanted to study.
Right.
You know, leaving cert, you were taking 7 or 8 subjects, many of which I found difficult, only one of which I really was both good at and wanted to do. Once I had that focus, and once I had a social world that I found more congenial than an all-male, somewhat sports-oriented school, I felt I belonged in much more so, and probably has that as some, you know, why those friendships have tended to outlast the ones that I made at Belvedere.
Right. Yeah. Now, were you starting to date at this point? Had you dated earlier?
No.
No?
No.
Mm.
All that was way, way retarded by by American standards.
Okay, and how about academically, though? I mean, how are you? You feel at home here? You've got your focus of sort of research, or at least your of studies. Are you coming upon teachers and mentors who are important here?
At Trinity?
Right.
Some. Though it's the lecturing style there in some ways is more distant, and your interactions, social interactions, learning interactions were much more among your peers. Lectures were very much so. For the first 2 years, it was a lot larger group. It was all of the biology students together, and most lectures were in the, you know, sit down and listen to a lecturer for an hour, and then and take good notes, and then try and work them out yourself. Smaller group interactions came in. There was a tutorial system, and you were assigned a tutor who was, you know, among their duties was to bail you out should you get in jail. that didn't happen, but actually I didn't never, for one reason or the other, never felt the need to make use of it. It wasn't necessary. I don't think it was a science faculty person. It was just somebody assigned.
So sort of like a big brother, kind of.
The intention was just as an academic advisor. But let's see. Yeah, there were good lecturers there, but people at that stage were looking at people by how effectively they can convey information. So I think back to those days when I'm now trying to do the same thing for large classes here in Stony Brook. I'm trying to remember what made a good lecturer then,
right,
which was exactly many of the qualities that I didn't have then and have had to pick up. And a couple of very energetic lecturers, I remember being impressed by how important energy and state, you know, and I've continually learned how important energy and stage presence is for a good lecturer, you know, and how you can have a great mind and still be totally turn a whole audience off if you don't put it across well enough.
It's true.
Enough oomph.
Now, were you doing lab work at this point at Trinity?
No. So first 2 years it was tended to be classes. Large classes. There was some labs, but they were more like demonstrations, and no research. Once you're in your third year, though, then you got into specialized, and then you were tracked into separate small departments with a much smaller, so let's say about a group of 12 undergraduates, which would function much more like a first-year graduate class here than an undergraduate class. That is, we were given desks in a room in the department, would have small group lectures from faculty members in that department. So there, yes, you got a much stronger impression of individual faculty.
Okay. I mean, eventually, in what year did you get, I couldn't find this, in what year did you get your BA at Trinity?
So that's the final degree, that's the primary degree, and that would have been at the end of the fourth year.
Okay.
So for research experience, one of the reasons probably that I picked genetics in particular to go on was because they were running this program where you got to go to usually the labs of alumni who had graduated and gone on to do research in other places, frequently in the U.S., and there was a chance to go and do research between your third and fourth years.
Oh,
so my first real taste of research was as a summer project in Cornell.
Oh, really?
Where there is an Indian guy being a graduate student, I think, at Trinity, and was working as a postdoc in a large research group at Cornell.
So at the point you're 16, 17?
No. This is at college.
No, I'm sorry. You're 21, 22. Okay. Get my math ready. And talk about that experience at Cornell.
That was great. That was expanding the range again. That was to answer two questions. That was, you know, do I like research but also that actually was my first extended time living away from my house, which seems incredibly late, but since I was living at home all the time I was in college, though for much of the time it's towards the end I was basically just sleeping there, and that was pretty much it. I was just first independent, living independently, and figuring out whether I liked lab research. So and the answer was, yeah, I liked both, and liked being in the U.S. as well.
Right. And what did you study? What was your focus?
It was the Boyce Thompson Institute for Plant Research, which was, I think, a privately funded but plant research institute on the Cornell campus, where they were doing a lot of work on nitrogen fixation, which is done by a symbiotic bacterium, rhizobium, in root nodules of legume plants. I think they wanted it for genetic manipulation of that bacterium. They wanted to try and isolate the RECA gene, the recombinase, from that bacterium. And I was trying to do it by complementation testing transformed E. coli, RECA deficient E. coli, with bits of rhizobium DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work. And I had a lot of fun trying to do it. It was, I think it was the one thing that I remember being impressed. There were a couple of things, significant things there. One was just the impression that the director of the institute, a guy called Aladar Zalay, or I don't know if he's the director of the institute or just of the large group that with which my immediate supervisor was working. It was a big scientist in his field and was asking me, and what did you get? What happened? And it was my first taste of having to produce a lab result that really wasn't just, for purposes of getting a grade,
mm-hmm.
but because they wanted to know. And although I was desperately inexperienced, if I produced anything, that result would have been worth just as much as if it had been produced by a real scientist at the place. And it was that sense of the scientific world, that's as an egalitarian world, that appealed to me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Where data is data, it doesn't matter who produces it. In fact, it does matter who produces it. But, you question data a lot more if it's a weird result produced by an undergrad who's just come into the lab, as was in this case, but
mm-hmm.
Than if it's somebody you trust. But still, when it comes down to it, it's the same datum. And I like that, almost that impersonality or personality independence of the scientific world.
Right.
A lot. The other thing that happened there was that I heard lectures by the Alan Spradling, who and Jerry Rubin had just figured out how to make transgenic Drosophila with P elements.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether I was consciously made the decision, but it looks like, that was the thing that made Drosophila, revived it as a tractable experimental system, being able to put genes back into flies easily. And later on, when I went back into graduate school, the first three rotations were all in fly labs. That system appealed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a question I wanted to ask you, and I just slipped my mind. I'll find it again. I'm sorry, how long did you spend in this lab?
Maybe 2 months, 10 weeks.
Oh, really? Okay.
And
what was your impression of America when you first come here?
So I have to go back a little ways then, because my first impression of America came when I was 14.
Okay.
I'd mentioned that my mother's brother, Des Perry, he'd ended up in Chicago after previous careers as a missionary priest in Nigeria, and ended up marrying a previous nun,
mm-hmm.
and they now divide their time between Chicago and Florida. But she was a Brazilian and had got into early childhood education, got into the Montessori field, and we were running Montessori school in Chicago when I visited them when I was 14. Mm-hmm. So my first impression of America came when I visited them for a summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on this summer, I visited them again when I was at Cornell that summer and did some looking around at graduate schools and that stage as well. First impression of America is, big. everything is big. And it still is, the reverse holds true. When you go back to Ireland, everything's small. And you think, yeah, I can't possibly fit into that car. They come to get you.
Right.
But, yeah, stuff like, I think, an Arby's roast beef sandwich. Everyone remembers their first American meal.
Exactly.
And it sounds like you're coming from this desperately deprived background, which is not the case at all. And that's, you know, kind of wanted to, by emphasizing the middle class thing, I was trying to make sure that impression wasn't conveyed. Americans often assume that any immigrant is, by definition, coming from a deprived background. But we didn't, it wasn't the case. Think of it. But it's just so different, and there's that sense of, a sandwich in Ireland is something that has two pieces of white bread with maybe, if you're lucky, one layer of ham in it. Maybe, if you're feeling luxurious, a layer of cheese.
Right.
Not because you can't afford more, but, who needs more?
Mm-hmm.
And this thing that I was presented with on the way back from the airport when I said, I was a little bit hungry, was this mound of half a carcass of a cow between these two great big buns. And I can't get my mouth around half of this.
Right.
So that was strange from the outset. It was Chicago in the summer.
That is hot.
I was coming from Ireland, and the kids, the local kids thought, wow, here's this kid over from Dublin. They play soccer there all the time. Soccer was just coming in. He's going to be great at soccer. You tell us how to play soccer.
Right.
I wasn't all that. I'd played some on the street. Yes, that was what I would normally do on the street at home, but I got there, it was 95 degrees. I just wanted to stay draped over an air conditioner.
Right.
People would come try and roll me out. But, I was politically aware enough, I think, at the time to be, I think that was the year E.T. came out.
Okay.
As a movie, and I thought that was a very American movie, because it pretended to an innocence that the rest of the world didn't view America as having it be entitled to. And so that probably tells, yes, I was in my disagreeable teenager phase at that stage. Well into it.
Right. Any other memories then? E.T., I like this. E.T., Arby's, very concrete.
Yeah.
Well, how about the American character, though? I mean, I just spoke with someone who, a Swiss man, I met him on 47th and 5th, where I was having lunch. He had just run the New York Marathon. I asked him, what he thought of America, and he said, he loved it, because Americans were just so optimistic. They were always smiling. They were always happy. And, he talked a little bit about Europe and the conditions there and perhaps why, to his mind, they were smiling less and why Americans have reasons to smile more. But, it was interesting, his perception of American national type again.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, what was your own perception of that?
That, right, it was, I didn't know enough then to make any perceptive conclusions. People seemed generous, friendly. I think they'll invite you into your homes. They'll share what they'll. There seemed to be a lot more of the world at their disposal. They could have. Why don't you come up and visit our place on the lake? A place on a lake. We don't do places on lakes.
Right.
We don't have places on lakes. We bike 50 miles to see a place on a lake, and then we go home again. It's there is that sense of something of a sense of abundance, but particularly for at that time in particular, I think there was this mixture of anti-American political feeling, which would have been best expressed, perfectly expressed by a teenager in disagreeable mode.
Right.
So I would have been both reacting against that. Again, I'm sure it was just as disagreeable a guest as I would have been a son.
Okay. If you like, we can leave it there and we'll pick it up again tomorrow, or?
Right. I'm just trying to think. Let's see. So that last digression had brought us away from impressions of the U.S. when I back when I was at Cornell first. Yeah. So yes, I think impressions got more concrete when I went back in that summer, and then subsequently, but felt I could go back to graduate school.
So Cornell then was your third visit then to the U.S.
Cornell would have been my Cornell would have been my second visit to the U.S. First in 14, then when I was 14, then I went over for that summer, and then I would have gone back to go to graduate school after graduating.
Okay. So what we'll do then next time when we begin is we'll talk a little bit about finishing up at Trinity and then coming across to do your graduate studies
Sounds
at the University of Wisconsin.